Okay, folks, it's the last week before spring break. You know what this means, right? Get caught up. Because the week you come back from spring break, that Friday is when you're DCF. I know some of you still haven't picked a company. I know it. You know how I know it? Because I was checking that Google shared spreadsheet yesterday. And there are about 50 of you who don't have a company name there. You might already have picked the company, finished the valuation, and not put the name in. But if you haven't picked a company, pick a company. You can't do a valuation without picking the company first. And if you can figure out how to do the reverse, let me know. That's genius if you can pull it off. Okay? Couple of things. I've still left the valuation quizzes out there, the remaining. There are about 12 or 15 left. I'm going to take them back in today because I just gave out my corporate finance quiz today. So I'm going to grade that and put it out, and I can't have two piles. They're going to get mixed up. So I've still left the remaining quizzes upstairs in case you haven't picked up yours. I was actually in Nigeria I left on Wednesday. I was there Thursday, Friday. So the emails you got were from Nigeria. So if your computer blocked them, it's not my fault. Maybe it's set up to block Nigerian emails in general. But I think, people told me all kinds of scary stories about Nigeria, that there'd be, you needed armed guards when you got there. It's actually safer than Chicago. That might be a little too far, but it's not as dangerous as some of the cities. So I've actually decided to up my game, and next month I've decided I should go to Venezuela. And the month after that, to North Korea. I'll let you know how these different expeditions go out. Okay? So let's start today with some loose ends. Today is going to be all about finishing the last of the loose ends. Let's start with some very quick questions. One of the things we're going to talk about today is how to deal with complex companies. You know what I mean, complex companies? Some of you are actually valuing complex companies. Carolina, for instance, valuing Valiant. Very, very complex company. Very messy company. Some of the complexity comes from the internal problems the company has. Some from, you know, so you will be very complex companies. And as you're going through the complex company, you're going to notice that every estimate you make is like pulling teeth. So I'm going to ask you a question. It's a very generic question. And I want you to think like an investor. Let's say you have two companies. They look exactly the same in terms of cash flows and growth and everything number driven. They look exactly like. But company A is a simple company and company B is a complex company. So the only thing different about them is one is simple, one is complex. As an investor, don't forget about all the valuation mechanics. As an investor, which of these two companies would you value more highly? Company A because it's a simple company, company B because it's a more complex, diversified company, or would you not care? Come on, it can't be that complicated. Yeah. You don't care? Okay, in fact, that's what every textbook asks you to do, right? Who cares about complexity? And when you say you don't care, why wouldn't you care? You know what you're hoping will happen? That what you don't know will get averaged out. What I mean by that is if you buy 50 complex companies, you're hoping that, you know, in some of the companies you're going to screw up in one direction, some you're going to screw up in the other direction. It's a diversification argument. The only problem is if you think about complex companies, these are companies where managers have held back information, right? Now let me ask you a follow-up question. When managers hold back news, is it more likely to be good news or bad news? Have you seen any accounting scandals where the company wakes up and says, you know what, we made 4 times more money than you thought we did? Have you noticed when there's an accounting scandal, it's always in one direction? I think it's very dangerous to ignore complexity, that assume that what you don't know is not going to hurt you because we know it's more likely. So today we're going to talk about what to do about complexity. Because I think complex companies should trade at a discount on simple companies, even if every number looks the same. Second, let's say you've finished a discounted cash flow valuation of a company. You've come up with a value of $100 million. Okay? The firm has debt outstanding with a face value of $100 and a market value of $80 million. Actually, let me pause right there. When you have a face value of 100 for the debt and the market value is 80 million, why is the debt trading at a discount on its face value? What causes debt to trade at a discount? What's the value of debt? It's the present value of the cash flows on the debt, the coupons at the market interest rate for the debt, right? So the market interest rate for the debt goes up, the market value of the debt goes down. And what causes the market interest rate on debt for a company to go up? Somebody said, risk? Yeah, it's risk. But what kind of risk does it have to be? It's distress risk. Your risk that the company is going to go under. So as a company gets more distressed, its market value of debt will actually decrease. So this is a distressed company with $100 million in face value of debt and a market value of debt of $80 million. So I wanted to estimate the value of equity in this company. Ready? I've done a DCF valuation, come up with $100 million. Face value is $100 million. Market value of the debt is $80 million. What is the value of equity in this company? And I'll go through the choices and you tell me which one you would pick. I could pick, I should say, 20 million, knock off the last zero. So 20 million, which is 100 minus 80. It could be zero, which is 100 minus 100. Or maybe neither answer is right. So the question I'm asking you is, when I subtract out debt to get to the value of equity, should I use face value of debt, which is what I owe if I pay off the debt, or should I use market value of debt? Let's say I use market value of debt. I tell you the equity is worth 20 million. You buy shares in the company at 20 million. What's the biggest worry? As the distress starts to ease, what's going to happen to the market value of the debt? It's going to go from 80 back to 100 million. And there goes your $20 million value, right? But if you're a going concern, what you hope will happen is the value of your business, instead of being 100 million, will go up to 150 or 180. But this is actually one of the great unresolved questions in valuation. We know we should use market value of debt to get to cost of capital. We know we should do a DCF valuation based on cost of capital. We're still not quite sure whether you should subtract out the face value of the debt or the market value of debt. And we're going to come back and talk about this. When would you subtract out the face value of debt? And when will you subtract out the market value of debt? One final question. Let's say you have a company which has 100 million shares outstanding, and you value the equity at $1 billion. So value of the equity is $1 billion, you have 100 million shares outstanding. What's your value per share? Come on, it's $1 billion divided by 100, which is $10 per share, right? Now let's assume this company grants 10 million options to its CEO. And the strike price is set equal to the value per share, $10. After they grant these options, you are an existing shareholder, the shares were worth $10 per share, they're now given 10 million options, but the options are at the money. Will your value per share be affected by this option grant? Do you think it'll go down, go up, remain the same? Let's go through the choices. How many would think it'll go up now that I've issued 10 million options to my managers? Okay, that's good, right? We got that out of the way. How many think it'll be unaffected? And your rationale would be that because it's a, so basically you're saying if I give options which are at the money, you're okay with that? You see where I'm going to go next? What if I granted myself $1 billion options at the money? He said, don't worry about it, it's worth nothing. Have you ever tried buying an at the money option, the Chicago Board of Options? Try. And then refuse to pay. So these are at-the-money options, we don't pay. Only an accountant thinks an at-the-money option is worth nothing. Because as long as an option has life, it has value. That at-the-money option that you grant to the managers are not free. Even though they're at-the-money now, doesn't mean that they will be at-the-money forever. So those options have value. And what have I done? I've given some of your equity away to the CEO. And guess what? You're going to wake up to a much lower value per share. And we're going to talk about that as well today. What do you do about management options? How do they affect your value of equity as a company? So let's get started because we have quite a few loose ends to hit. So we're on page 221. And I'm going to start, and I need you to help me because I can't pull the whole wagon for the rest of the class. I need your help here. So let's assume you're valuing a company. You've discounted the cash flows, free cash flow of the firm at the cost of capital. You ended up with $1 billion. And this firm has $200 million in debt. So first question, this is the easy one. What's the value of equity in the company? $1 billion minus $200 million is $800 million, right? So write down the $800 million because now we're going to get messy. Let's assume you're told that company A owns 10% of company B. So company A is the one that you just valued. It owns 10% of company B. The holdings are accounted for as passive holdings. Remember last class we talked about passive holdings? And the market cap of company B is $500 million. Will this affect the value of equity that you came up with? Remember you told me it's $1 billion minus $200, $800. Now I've thrown this in the mix that they own 10% of company B. It's a minority passive holding. You have three choices, right? You can add, subtract, or ignore. So what are you going to do with this? Are you going to add, subtract, or ignore? And whatever you choose, tell me why. You want to try? What are you going to do? Add, subtract, or ignore? Okay, that's the right answer. So let's dig deeper. Why would you add? Why haven't I already counted it? What if I played devil's advocate? I already did the DCF. Why isn't it in the cash flows? Because it's just a passive. And go the next step. And I did my free cash flow. I started with operating income as my measure of income. And because this shows up below the operating income line, I haven't counted it yet. So you have to add the 10%. So what's that 10% worth? 10% of 500 million is 50 million. But we're being a little sloppy, right? Because we're using the actual market cap. We're not actually valuing company B from scratch. But no, at least it's a shot. So 800 plus 50. Everybody with me so far? So I'm adding 10% of the minority holding. Now let's make life really complicated. I forgot to tell you that company A owns 60% of company C. What are you required to do again if you own 60%? You're required to consolidate. So when I did my free cash flow to the firm, I used operating income of two companies and I used 100% of company C's operating income and I did my valuation. And now I'm telling you, hey, you know what? I own only 60%. So what should I do with that 40% that doesn't belong to me? Because that's what's captured in the minority interest, right? Should I add, subtract, or ignore? Subtract, and tell me why. Exactly, you subtract because I acted like I owned 100% when I did my free cash flow of the firm, and I'm saying, that's not right. The 40% doesn't belong to you, so I'm going to subtract. But here, what am I subtracting out? I'm subtracting out minority interest, and minority interest reflects the book value of the 40% that doesn't belong to me. So in a sense, you can see the mishmash I've created. My $800 million was a discounted cash flow valuation. The $50 million is an actual market price. And the $40 million that I'm subtracting out is a book value. I'll give you a number, $810 million, but this is a complete mess. If I wanted this to make this a true discounted cash flow valuation, Anna, what should I do? If I wanted to, you're daydreaming here, so I'm going to bring you back. So what should I? What do I need to do with these three companies? Because here, I need to do a DCF for each one, right? If I did a DCF of each one, company A, B, and C, let's assume I told you that I did a DCF of company B and told you the value of company B based on a DCF is $250 million. And for company C, I told you the value of the entire company that I got from a DCF is $250 million. Now let's see what the answer would be. You start with the $800. But the 10% of company B would now be $25 million. 10% of, no? And what would I subtract out to get to the value of equity? 40% of $250 million, which is $100 million. 800 plus 25 minus 100 will give me a value of equity of 725 million. In a perfect world, this is how you do cross holdings. But you can already see why this is going to be incredibly messy, right? Because in a perfect world, I will value the parent company standing alone. Then I will take each subsidiary that you have, do a discounted cash flow valuation of that subsidiary. And then I will take 10% of one and 5% of the other and 7% of the third one, add them all together. What a nightmare, right? Because especially the cross-holdings become larger and larger in number. Think of the number of DCF valuations you have to do. But we don't live in a perfect world. And I'll tell you a story to bring home how difficult it is to value cross-holdings, right? In the late 90s, I was actually updating one of my valuation books, and I valued a Japanese company. In the late 90s, you valued a Japanese company, you were always teetering on the edge of disaster because the yen risk-free rate then was so low relative to the rest of the world. If you weren't careful, the valuation would blow up. So I was very careful. I finished the valuation of the Japanese company. I'm patting myself on the back, and I open up the annual report, and it says they have 226 cross-holdings. Now, if I'm one of those careful, hard-working analysts, which I'm not, what am I supposed to do next? Value each of the 226 companies one at a time, and there is no way I'm even going there. But even if I'd wanted to go that route, I couldn't have done it, and here's why. 160 of the 226 companies were privately owned companies, private businesses, and there was zero information, nothing given on the companies, no revenues, no operating income, no cash flows. So I called the investment relations officer of the Japanese company and said, look, I'm valuing your company for a book. It's not for an expose. I need some information on these cross holdings to finish my valuation. Could you give me that information? She said, I cannot. It is proprietary. The way she said proprietary was quite scary. I said, really? Okay, if I bought 1,000 shares in your company, and then I called you, what? She said, still be proprietary. I said, let me get this straight. I'm a part owner of your company and you're refusing to tell me what I own. Is that right? She said, well, now that you put it that way, you have a point. But it's still proprietary. At this point, I'm feeling like I'm whacking my head against a brick wall. So I get ready to hang up the phone. And she says, no, I do have something useful I can tell you. So maybe she's going to give me some numbers, like revenues from the subsidiaries. I said, what? She said, I cannot give you any specifics, but they're worth a lot. I said, let me get this straight. So all I need to do is go into my Excel spreadsheet where it says value of cross holdings. I enter LOT. It's not working. It's giving me an error message. Something must be wrong. But I think this cuts to the heart of the cross holding culture, where managers think if they hold up a brown paper bag and says, trust me, it's full of cash, that you'll take them at their word. Come on, you live in New York City. Somebody walks up to you with a brown paper and says, trust me, it's full of cash. My advice to you is turn and run in the opposite direction. Because there's no cash there. It's probably a gun, and you open it up and they're going to shoot you. Okay? But that's what we do in cross-holding companies. We take their word. It's worth $120 billion. Okay, if you say so. So in the real world, the problem you often face is doing this right. So I'm going to take you through a company where I did it right. And then I'm going to take you through what I would have done if I hadn't had the information. So you're familiar with Yahoo, right? It's in its death throes now. But at one point in time, it was an incredibly successful company in the late 90s. It was the search engine that everybody used. Those days are, of course, history. So this is a valuation I did of Yahoo about 3 years ago. And actually, I bought Yahoo after I did the valuation. So I'll take you through the process. So I took their free cash flow to the firm, and I discounted the cost of capital. So I did everything we did in the class. I came up with a value for the operating assets of Yahoo of $4.4 billion. The stock's market cap was about $35 to $36 billion. This is horrible, right? Even if I add cash and subtract our debt, the value for just Yahoo was about $7.4 billion, well below the market cap. But here's what I hadn't valued yet. Is two cross holdings that Yahoo has, which are insanely valuable. One was 21% or 22% of Alibaba, and the other was 35% of Yahoo Japan, which is a separate standalone publicly traded company. They're not included in my valuation. Why? Because these are minority holdings, and because they're minority holdings, the income shows up below the operating income line. But the advantage I had with these two cross holdings, they're both public companies. So I went and put up the financials for Yahoo Japan and the financials for Alibaba. And this is why I had to wait till Alibaba's IPO to actually do this, because until then, Alibaba was a private company. I wouldn't have known it. But once Alibaba decided to file its prospectus, I valued their company. And here's what I got for Yahoo Japan. For some reason, the Japanese seem to still use Yahoo search engines. Don't ask me why. So Yahoo Japan is actually a much healthier, much more profitable company. The value that I got for their operating assets was about $18 billion. And the value of equity in Yahoo Japan was $21 billion. 35% of $21 billion is $7.3 billion. Then I went to Alibaba. This is your gold mine. The value that I got for the operating assets of Alibaba, this was about 3 months before their IPO, was $127 billion. The value of equity in Alibaba was $145 billion. 22% of $145 billion is $32 billion. So here's what I get when I buy shares in Yahoo. I get a piece of this. I get this and this as well. You add those three numbers up, the value that you get is $7.4 billion plus $7.4 billion plus $32 billion. Overall, you get a value of almost $46 billion. What did I say? What did I say the market cap was? It was $36 billion. I looked at it and said, what am I missing here? And the one thing that did worry me was, if they decided to, and in fact, Alibaba, when it went public, was required Yahoo to sell off 8% of its holding, I think. It was required as part of the IPO. The minute Yahoo sells off that holding, what is it going to be faced with? Remember, it invested in Alibaba when it was a small company with a very low value. That's what it's recorded at. Now it's going to sell it at 8, 10, 12, 15 billion. There's going to be a capital gain. You'll have to pay taxes on that. That's the taxes due that I subtracted. I said, look, if you have to sell the Alibaba, I'm not going to get that $5 billion. I subtracted the taxes due. And the value that I got for the equity was about $41.6 billion, giving me a share price, a value per share of 41. The stock was trading, as I said, at 35 or 36. I bought it. In fact, I just sold it a few months ago, just after Marissa Mayer threw in the towel, the whole thing. In fact, what's going to happen to Yahoo going forward? Actually, the operating assets are going to get sold off to Verizon, so that's gone. What are you left with? The two cross holdings. But they're going to stay on as a company. That's why I call it the Walking Dead company, with the two cross holdings. You know why I want them to stay on as a company, the cross holdings? Because as they stay on as a company, they don't have to sell the cross holdings. If they don't sell the cross holdings, they don't have to pay taxes. So if you want to buy Alibaba shares, there's an easier way to get there than buying Alibaba shares and going through the Cayman Islands or wherever you have to go. Just buy Yahoo shares. Yahoo is now a holding company with a piece of Alibaba, a big piece of Alibaba. It's about 75% Alibaba shares and 25% Yahoo Japan shares. at the time that I actually wrote about, you know, Yahoo way back, you know, and this was when Marissa Mayer was hired as CEO. I said, this is, you're not going to turn this company around. You can see why, right? Because her mission was what? To turn Yahoo around. Why is it going to be impossible to do? Because if you look at the value, where does the value of Yahoo come from? It's not what they do as Yahoo, it's Yahoo Japan. On any given day, what Jack Ma does at Alibaba has a bigger effect on Yahoo's stock price than what Marissa Mayer does at Yahoo. And it took her 5 years to discover this. Okay. She finally threw in the towel, but I never knew why she accepted this job. I know why she accepted the job. It's a chance to be, it's a glamorous CEO position. You want to be CEO, you want to turn companies around. But this is not the kind of company that's going to be easy to turn around. But here you could see the Cross Holdings fully valued because I had the information to do the intrinsic valuation. But in most cases, you won't have this luxury of being able to get full financials. So I'm going to suggest a couple of approximations. If you have an investment in another company, whether it's a majority or a minority holding, okay, if it's not publicly traded, and you don't have the information to do a discounted cash flow valuation, my suggestion is that you price the holding. Let me explain. Let's assume that you have a holding in another company and the book value of the holding is $100 million. You know it's a chemical company. It's not publicly traded, but the book value is $100 million. What if I told you the typical chemical company trades at 1.6 times book value? In fact, on my website, I have an average price to book ratio by sector. What should you use as the value of your holding? You're going to take the $100 million. You're going to say the typical chemical company trades at 1.6 times at holding. Your estimated value is going to be $160 million. It's very, very, you know, it's an approximation, I agree. But it's better than just taking the book value as a given because it allows you to bring that into the process. And just to illustrate how this would have worked with Yahoo, if I'd not had the intrinsic valuation, I could have done a pricing of Yahoo, where instead of doing a discounted cash flow valuation of the three pieces, I applied a multiple to each of the three pieces. And I could have added up the multiple value, and based on the pricing, which was basically a much more approximate approach, the value per share that I got was about $39 per share. So Cross Holdings are messy. They're messy because they're accounted for in so many different ways. We know how to do them right, but all too often we've got to settle for these approximations because we don't have the information. Any questions on Cross Holdings? Now let's talk about, so at this stage, let's see where we are. You did a DCF valuation of your company, right? Then you added cash, and we talked about all the caveats with cash, and then you've dealt with the Cross Holdings. So you're almost done, and you look around you and say, is there anything else I should be bringing into my valuation? You're looking for any assets you might have ignored. And my guess is you're going to look at the balance sheet. Say, is there something there? Steer away from double counting any asset in a company. Let me explain. If you have a headquarters building in New York City, let's say you own the headquarters building. J.P. Morgan, I think, owns 270 Park and one of those two buildings, 270 Park or 277 Park. It's probably worth $500, $600 million. Could I do a discounted cash flow valuation of J.P. Morgan, and then add the $500 million for the headquarters building? Am I allowed to do that? Why not? Well, it can be cap. No, let's assume they owned it outright. Let's make this really simple. Let's say they had cash. I don't know where they got the cash. They bought the building. Let's say they owned the building. Should I count the half a billion? Who's in that building? It's not an empty building, right? There are traders in there. What are they doing? They're trading. And what does the trading create? Hopefully income, not losses. That income goes into my cash flows, which I've discounted to get. You see where I'm going? If I've taken the present value of the cash flows, I can't, on top of that, add the value of the assets that generated the same cash flows. That would be double counting. So if you are valuing a company, be careful not to double count. So if I'm valuing an oil company, I can't finish my discounted cash flow valuation, then add the cost of the refineries and the value of the refineries and the value of the ships, because that's what allows me to get my cash flows. So when we talk about looking for other assets, just be careful you're not adding in assets you've already counted in your discounted cash flow valuation. If you have an overfunded pension plan as a company, overfunded pension plans arise when you set aside too much money to cover the pensions you've promised your employees. Technically, the overfunding belongs to you as an equity investor. Maybe you'll add that on. Though be careful, because taking it out is not as easy as it sounds. You have to pay some hefty taxes. But maybe overfunded pension plans you could add on. But what you're looking for are truly vacant assets. I'll give you an absurd example. Let's say you have a CEO who loves fine art. So what does he do? He buys Picassos with shareholders' money. He hangs them up all over the headquarters building. See, you have 100 Picassos hanging over around the building. It's like a museum. Each Picasso is worth $1 million. So that's 100 times a million is $100 million. That's not in your discounted cash flow valuation. Picassos don't throw off cash flows, but they belong to you as shareholders. That's a vacant asset. You say, how many companies am I going to buy with 100 Picassos? You'd be surprised what old companies have accumulated over time as part of their assets. Some old European companies have chateaus that belong to them. The people who stay in them are usually not you and I as shareholders, but somebody should. But there are entire assets that you might not have counted. So when you talk about other assets, you're looking for assets you haven't counted yet. So let me give you a story to illustrate the kind of asset that might be the kind of assets you should be counting. Have you heard of the Michael Price Fund? Stern, it's actually Ed Stern. Let me give you the backstory. About 15 years ago, a guy called Michael Price sold his mutual fund to the Japanese for $2 billion. And he's an old Stern graduate. So what happens when an old Stern graduate gets rich very quickly? What does Stern do? They go in and ask him for money, right? They have your name in a Rolodex. Now they know you're worth $2 billion. So they asked me whether I would go ask Michael Price for money. I said, are you kidding me? I don't go ask. They said, you have to. We need some money. And what finally convinced me was what they wanted the money for. They wanted to use it to seed a student-run portfolio. That's what the Michael Price Fund is. The fund is actually run by MBAs who run it like a mutual fund. They pick stocks, and every 2 years, a new group of MBAs comes in. There are about 15 or 20 MBAs involved. So we went and asked him, and he gave us $10 million, which we used to seed the fund. I've not been involved officially in that fund, but almost everybody who's involved in the fund has gone through my valuation class, and because they have to make pitches to the other people on the fund for stocks they want to add, they'll come and try their pitches out on me. So, what do you think about this one? So about 6 or 7 years ago, I'm sitting in my office, you know, second-year MBA comes in, who's in the Michael Price Fund, and he says, I'm facing a conundrum. I very quickly turn to my computer, type in the word conundrum. So he's very, okay, confused. Yeah, but I like the word. I said, I'm going to use it on him. He said, what's your conundrum? I said, my conundrum is I'm valuing Playboy. And I said, I don't see a conundrum. See how many times I threw conundrum into the conversation? He said, I valued Playboy, and I've come up with a value of $240 million. The stock is trading at $280 million. And I said, I still don't see a conundrum. You valued at $240, the stock's trading at $280. Don't buy it. He said, here's my conundrum. There's one very valuable asset that I haven't counted in the discounted cash flow valuation. And it could make the difference. What was he talking about? The Playboy Mansion. The Playboy Mansion is one of the most valuable pieces of property in Los Angeles. It's huge. And it technically belongs to Playboy, the company. It's worth $150 to $200 million. See why he had the conundrum? You add the $150 million to the $240, you go well above the market cap. The stock looks cheap. So the question he was asking is, can I add the $150 million? Can he? It's one small catch, right? There's an 85-year-old in a bathrobe who's hanging out in that mansion. And you can't exactly evict him without some substantial public relations blowback. Hugh Hefner. So he said, what should I do? I said, check out the actuarial tables. He said, what am I checking for? Check to see how long 85-year-olds who surround themselves with 26-year-old playmates tend to live. It's incredible stress, I would think, on your heart that you're putting. Let's say it's 5 years. You know what you have to do next, right? If you come up with 5 years, what do you need to do? You need to take the $150 million, discount it back 5 years, and what you get can be added on to the $240 million, and you're done. Last year, this issue resolved itself. I don't know whether you read this news story, but there's the Playboy Mansion. Last year, it was sold for $200 million with Hugh Hefner in the house. You're saying, who wants to buy Hugh Hefner? It's actually a very interesting sale. Playboy sold the house on the condition that Hefner will continue to live in the house till he dies. This is some Greek multimillionaire who bought it. But he wants it for the patina, right? The parties that have happened there, the memories of times past, whatever it is. And he was willing to pay $200 million for a house that he won't be able to live in. So he's sitting there saying, is he dead yet? Is he dead yet? I have a feeling that Hugh Hefner's final revenge is going to be, he's going to be lived to be 127. Okay? And the Greek millionaire is going to die before Hugh Hefner, and God only knows what happens then. But they got $200 million. So now the conundrum is gone. Today, if you value Playboy, you're going to see a $200 million cash balance. You say, this is a truly unutilized asset. I haven't valued it yet. I can bring it into the picture. So now let's talk about complexity. I'm going to show you two companies. And this is very similar to the star, but I'm going to flesh it out a little. The two companies have exactly the same numbers, same operating income, same growth rate, same cost of capital. Everything looks the same in terms of numbers. But here's where they're different. Company A is in a single business. Company B is in multiple businesses. Company A has a very simple holding structure. They tell you what they own, and you can see what they own. Company B has special purpose entities, all kinds of layers. Company A has transparent accounting. Company B has opaque accounting. What's opaque accounting? This is one of those financial statements you read and you're not sure what language it's in. Claims to be English. What is this? You read it again, you get even more confused. It's clearly written by lawyers to confuse you. And they've done their job. So here you have simple company versus complex company. And we've already talked about why, as an investor, you want to value the simple company more highly. But as I said, I made a confession. If you open up my valuation book to the chapter on DCF valuation, you work through the numbers, you're going to get the same value for the two companies. And this never bothered me till 2002. And in 2002, a company called Tyco had an accounting scandal. It lost 80% of its market cap as a result. And in the weeks after the Tyco scandal, GE lost 15% of its value. What's GE got to do with Tyco? You remember, any of you heard of Tyco? What kind of company was it? It was a conglomerate that got built up through acquisitions. What kind of company is GE? It's a conglomerate that got built up through acquisitions. You see how investors were thinking, right? Because they're saying, this conglomerate we trusted, and they had an accounting scandal. How do we know GE is not pulling a fast one on us? They discounted the value of GE because it was a complicated company. And I was teaching my MBA valuation class at that time. So I came in and threw this idea out. You know what? No, we must be doing this wrong because clearly complexity can hurt you. How do we bring it into a valuation? And they said, yeah, we need to explore this, by which they meant that I should be exploring it and telling them how to do it. So I said, okay, and I'll be back next session with a measure of complexity, because if I'm going to bring it into my valuation, I've got to measure it. So I'll have to tell you, even before I show you how my first measure of complexity, when I showed it to my MBAs, they were not impressed. Because here's what I did. I counted the number of pages in the most recent 10Q and 10K. You think, this is so simplistic. Guilty as charged. Let me ask you a question, though. If you wanted to avoid a company to value in this list, which one are you going to stay away as far as you can from? 1,026 pages. This is in War and Peace. This is how many pages it took them to tell you what happened last year. 1,000 pages? You must be one heck of a messed up company. So I put this up. My MBAs were not in the least bit impressed. They said, we're not paying $150,000 to count pages. We want something more sophisticated. I said, you know what? What was I thinking? I'll be back next week. And next week I came back with what I call my valuation shit list. These are all the things that bug me when I'm valuing a company and how much they bug me. I can create a spreadsheet out of almost everything. So I said, you know what? I'm going to create a spreadsheet that tells me how much a company bugged me in the process of valuing the company. I'll give you some examples of things that bug me. A company that claims to be geographically diversified but doesn't tell you where. What the heck is that supposed to mean? Or it tells you where and you start reading the regions of the world that they describe and none of them look familiar to you. It's like a Lord of the Rings universe. Where is that? Where is that? I've never heard of that. I still remember the first time I valued BMW. They broke their revenues down by region. They said North America, South America, Europe, Oceania. So what? I don't remember Oceania. Maybe it's the lost continent, Atlantis or something. Maybe they're selling cars underwater. Where is Oceania? So I called the investment relations officer of BMW and said, you know what, I'm backing a company. I see Oceania. Where is Oceania? They said, it's Australia, New Zealand, and Indonesia. I said, what do they share in common? They said, they're all by an ocean. I said, really? That's your definition of Oceania? If I use that definition, what is it? 75% of the world is in Oceania. What am I left with? A few landlocked countries like Latvia? What do I do with these? And you see by mixing up Australia and New Zealand, Australia and Indonesia, why they've made life really difficult for me? How do I compute equity risk premiums? I take a weighted average, right? When you combine Australia and Indonesia and you call them one region, one is a really high equity risk premium country. The other is a mature market. You put them together. How the heck am I even going to? You're running into variations of this with your company, right? Rest of the world. Come on, guys, start being specific. Latin America. And Latin America could be Chile. It could be Venezuela. Africa. It could be Nigeria. It could be South Africa. So how much they bug me? So basically, I took all these, effective tax rates that go from positive to negative back to positive. So somebody's playing games. And I created a weighted average. The higher that number, the more complex your company. So I came back and put this up in front of my MBAs, and I said, do you like this more? They said, yes, yes. This is the way MBAs should think. I said, there's one small cost you're going to pay. To get this score for Citigroup, what do I need to do? Read 1,026 pages, right? I said, I'm not doing that. But each of you is valuing a company this semester, right? And they could see the train coming at them right down the tracks. But at this stage, it's too late to get out of the way. I said, this semester, I'd like to add one more to-do to your to-do list. In addition to doing evaluation and pricing of a company, why don't you do a complexity score for your company? They bitched and they moaned. But they had no choice. They should have just taken my number of pages in the 10K and let it go, right? So that semester, in addition to getting valuation of my companies, I got a complexity score. And I'll summarize what they found. They found zero correlation between company size and complexity. Does that surprise you? It surprised me. I thought big companies would be complex and small companies would be, but there wasn't any correlation. There were small companies that were incredibly complex and big companies like Walmart that were very easy to deal with. They found that that emerging market companies were about 25 to 30% more complex than developed market companies, usually because of cross-holding structures and accounting issues. They found that companies that grew through acquisitions were almost 30 to 40% more complex than companies that grew by internal investment. Why? Because acquisitions create all kinds of debris, right? Restructuring charges, goodwill, you don't know what to do with it. And finally, they found that any company with a financing arm was more complex than a company with... What am I talking about, financing arm? GM, GMAC, Ford, Ford Capital. Why does it make life difficult? Because it's like putting a bank right in the middle of a manufacturing company and say, trust me, there's a Chinese wall around that bank. All the debt goes to the bank. How the hell do I know? You might be climbing up and down the Chinese wall every day and I have no way of catching you. The most complex company that semester in the class. Think about it. The perfect storm. A company that is grows through acquisitions. A company that has a financing arm. A company with lots of special purpose holdings. Who do I be describing? G? G was the most complex company. I've said this before. My vision of hell is to be forced to value GE day in and day out. I know somebody in this class is actually valuing GE. Hey, I hope they emerge from the class sane because this is a company that's truly designed to drive you insane. But here's the most interesting result. The most transparent company, the least difficult company, the least complex company to value that semester, the class, was a company called Infosys. You know why I throw that out? It's an Indian company. And the reason I throw it out is anytime I go to an emerging market, like I was in Nigeria, and I talked about the fact that lots of Nigerian companies forget to report their debt. So what's with that? They said, it's all Nigeria, you know, we can't have, you know, it's complex. You can't stand behind. Basically, the requirements, oh, the information disclosure laws in this country are not that strong. As if information disclosure laws put a ceiling on what you can reveal rather than a floor. If you want to be transparent as a company, nothing's stopping you, if you're a Chinese company or an Indian company, from being transparent. So why aren't you? Because it serves your other purposes not to be transparent. It serves your control needs. It serves the fact that I can't oversee you if you're complex. Complex companies have themselves to blame as much as the rest of the world for what happens. So once you've measured the complexity, the question is, how do I bring it into valuation? So let's talk about the choices. You could be one of those analysts like the analysts in the late 90s who said, don't worry about complexity, it all averages out, just ignore it. You could be an analyst like some of the analysts in 2002 and 2003 after the first Tyco fiasco, saying, if there is any cross-holding, any complexity, I'm going to avoid the company. Or you could try to make an intermediate choice. Rather than completely avoiding or completely accepting, maybe you can try to incorporate complexity into your valuation. And let's think of the places you can do it. First is you can try to adjust your cash flows. Haircut the cash flows. So complex companies, maybe you will take the expected cash flow and knock off 5%. Why 5%? It's completely arbitrary, which is the weakness of that approach. The second is, maybe you can adjust the cost of capital for complex companies. In addition to bringing in risk-free rate, beta, and risk premium, maybe you can add an extra 1% to 2% for complexity, pushing up the cost of equity. You say, why 1% or 2%? Actually, what I did when I was writing this paper on complexity during my sabbatical was I took the S&P 500 and split it right down the middle into 250 complex and 250 simple companies. I had to make some choices. Then I computed the implied cost of equity for each half. And I found that the cost of equity I got for the 250 complex companies was about 1% higher than the cost of equity I got for the simple companies. Then we said, use the 1%. That pushes up your discount rate. But I'll give you my favorite way of dealing with complexity. What do we say the value of growth was? It comes from the fact that you earn a return greater than your cost of capital, right? So if you have a company earning a return on capital well above the cost of capital, it's a good thing. But when you show me that company, you know the question I'm going to ask you is, why do they earn more than their cost of capital? What is their competitive advantage? What are the barriers to entry? And if you have a good answer, I'm going to say, that's fine. Then assume the excess returns. But what if you have a company where you're not sure what they do? All you know is they make a lot of money. I'll give you an example. In the late 90s, one of the companies that would consistently get picked in these valuation classes was the then Enron. But Enron was a very successful company in the late 90s. $80 billion market cap. To a person, almost every person who valued Enron in this class would come to me about 6 weeks into the class and say, I face a conundrum. No, actually they didn't, but no. They said, look, I'm valuing Enron. I see that they make a lot of money, but I don't know what they do. You know what? You read the financials of the company. You had no idea. They call themselves energy traders. What is that? Who are you buying the energy from? Who are you selling the energy to? How come you're making money on this? It was a very, very diffuse company. And of course, there are all these special purpose entities that did God only knows what, that delivered profits. And at that time, we didn't know about the fraud behind the numbers. But my advice to them was, if you don't know what they do, then you can't assume they can earn an excess return for very long. Because you don't even know what they're compared. If you don't know what business they're in, how can you tell me what their comparative advantage is? So sometimes when you look at a company and you really don't understand what's going on, it's best to step back and say, you know what? I'll bring the excess returns down to zero because I don't understand the company. One final point before I leave. At the end of this paper, I actually did a regression where I took the 100 largest market cap companies and took the price-to-book ratios of the companies and regress them against return equity, beta, and growth. Pretty standard variables you throw in any time you try to explain price to book. We'll come back and talk about why. But in this regression, I also threw the number of pages in the 10K into the regression. Somebody help me out here. When I say minus 0.003 times number of pages in the 10K, first, every 100 additional pages in your 10K, what does it do to your price to book ratio? it lowers it by about 0.30, right? I know this is facetious, but let's try it. You know what Citigroup's price-to-book ratio is right now? Trades at less than 1, 0.9 times book value. I want to double Citi's price-to-book ratio from 0.9 to 1.8. So what am I going to advise them to do? Knock off 300 pages from your 10K. Sounds incredibly facetious, but think of why Citigroup ended up being the monster that they are today. I'll trace it back to a day in 1998 where a guy called Sandy Wild stood next to a guy called John Reed and announced they were creating the greatest financial supermarket in history. That was the Travelers Group combining with Citibank to create Citi. And they were going to create a financial service company. There was a bank, insurance company, investment bank, realtor, everything rolled into one. This isn't accidental that they've ended up where they are. And what this regression is saying is the market is punishing you for being a complex company. It's time to go back to being a simpler company. I mean, in fact, if I were giving advice to any of the money center banks, JP Morgan, Citigroup, no, you can go down there as Wells Fargo. My advice is simplify yourselves because investors are so terrified of your complexity that they're punishing you for being a complex company. You got to kind of step back from that complexity you've designed. Let's talk about debt. There are two places in valuation you run into debt. The first is when you do your cost of capital, you need to estimate the debt to use in the cost of capital. My advice to you at that stage is to be narrow in your definition of debt. In fact, I said count interest-bearing debt and lease commitments and let it go. Don't start to pile in everything into debt because that's actually going to lower your cost of capital. But once you've come up with the value of the business and you decide to subtract out debt, things get more interesting. The first issue that you run into, should I subtract out book value or market value? Let me give you the easy answer first and then give you the more difficult one. The easy answer is because you're doing a discounted cash flow valuation, which is a going concern concept, you should subtract out the market value of debt, even if it's a discount in the book value, because you don't pay the book value. But if you're liquidating the company, would your answer be different? Liquidate the company, you get the cash flow from the sales. Now you go to the bank and say, I'll pay you 50% of what I owe you. What's the bank going to say? No, that's not right. You're going to pay me the entire bank. So when you're doing liquidation valuation, you should stick with face value. But if you're doing a discounted cash flow valuation, you should, in fact, use market value. So narrow definition of debt when you do cost of capital. Market value of debt if you're doing a discounted cash flow valuation, which is a going concern value. And be expansive about bringing in anything else that worries you as an equity investor. Like what? If you have underfunded pension obligations and healthcare obligations, they will not be debt in your cost of capital. But when you decide to value the equity in GM or Ford, you should be subtracting out those underfunded pension obligations because they're not going to take care of themselves. You know what else you should worry about? For the last 25 years, if you do a pure discounted cash flow valuation of a tobacco company, almost every single tobacco company that I valued has looked cheap to me. Cash flow is discounted back at the cost of capital. What am I missing in my DCF that should hold me back from acting on that valuation? What's missing? The tobacco companies in the last 25 years, what's been hanging over the head of every tobacco company? Litigation, lawsuits, right? And when you lose a lawsuit on tobacco, if it's in Texas or Louisiana, they will give you $5 billion, $3 billion. I mean, we're not talking about $50 million, $40 million, $30 million. You could be wiping out entire segments of the company. And it's not just tobacco, right? Merck had those Vioxx lawsuits for 5 years. This is America. Everybody sues everybody else. So if you're a company, what makes you, especially if you're a company with lots of cash, the people are suing you. So if you're worried about lawsuits and the potential consequence of this, this is your last chance for dealing with it. So if you're valuing a company with a lawsuit, and if you lose that lawsuit, you think you're going to end up having to pay $100 million. You have to estimate the probability that you will lose that lawsuit and what your payment will have to be. You know how messy and difficult that is to do? Because it's not just one round, right? In the law, you lose the lawsuit. What do the tobacco companies do after they lost the lawsuit? They appealed and they appealed and they appealed. And 5 years later, the final court might say $5 billion becomes $50 million. This is an incredibly messy process and I have no way of dealing with it. So you know what you should get? A good trial lawyer friend. Because this is basically it. This is all they do. In fact, I remember about 5 years ago, I was sitting in my office, two students from the law school, right down the street, wandering to my office. They're third-year law students, which means they're on the verge of graduating. So they come into my office and say, we don't want to be lawyers. I said, why are you telling me? You're facing an existential crisis. Go talk to the dean of the law school about this. They said, we want to be in investing. I said, what do you know about investing? They said, nothing, but we're willing to learn. I said, you have too big a mountain to climb at this stage. But I have a suggestion. If you really want to be in investing, here's what I suggest you do. Create a niche business. You know what your niche business is going to be? You're going to follow only firms that have been sued and are targets of big lawsuits. And here's all you're going to do. You're going to let somebody else do the DCF valuation, all the rest of the stuff. And after they're done, they're going to come to you. And you're going to assess two things. One is what the expected outcome from the lawsuits is. It is, don't laugh, it's actually, if you can do this well, you can get rich really fast in the market because markets don't know how to deal with lawsuits. They just react to whatever the most recent news is. So when you talk about debt, be careful how you define it depending on where you are in the valuation. So let's close off the loose ends by talking about employee equity. Employee equity basically is equity you give to employees in the form of either restricted stock or options. Let's step back and look at what the difference is. With restricted stock, let's say you go to work for Uber or you go to work for Snap. So when they hire you, they might say, look, your pay package is $200,000. But let's face it, neither Uber nor Snap can afford to pay you $200,000. Why? How much money did Snap make last year? They lost $580 million. They have no money to pay you. So what are they going to pay you instead with? They're going to pay you with either shares you cannot trade. Those are the restricted shares. They're restricted because you're not allowed to trade them for 5 years and you have to work for 2 years to have them vested, or they're going to give you options. So let's start off with that statement. Companies give equity to their employees. There might be other incentive reasons, but the main reason is because they don't have the cash. And what I want to talk about is how these grants that have already been given by them, because by the time you invest in a company, it's been doing this for the last 5, 10, 15 years, you have a deadweight cost of past grants. How does that affect your value? And to the extent that they're continuing to do this, how will this affect your value if they keep doing it? So let's start with the first one. If you have restricted stock grants, which is the easier problem, if they've already been given, like if you look at Snap, Snap, I think, is almost 500,000 restricted stock units they've already given. My advice is keep it simple. Count them as shares outstanding and move on. So restricted stock units are easy to deal with because you just change the number of units in the company and you're done. But options are a pain in the neck. And to see why, let's think about what an option does. An option gives you as an employee the right to buy an additional share or buy a share in the company, right? At a fixed price. The key word is at a fixed price. If that fixed price is higher than the current stock price, you're obviously not going to exercise the option. So when are you going to exercise the option? It's when the stock price rises and your strike price or whatever price of grant is well below this. So the problem with options is I will be selling you shares at a discount on the market price when you exercise those options. And I pay for that as an equity investor. So with options, that becomes a question. How do you bring in this effect on equity without knowing what they're... Because at the time you do this, you don't know whether the options will be exercised, when they'll be exercised, or whether they'll be exercised, because you don't know what the future stock price will do. And you have to incorporate that into the value of equity plan. So I'm going to take you through three different ways of dealing with options. But to do that, I'm going to set up a pretty simple example. So let's assume you have a company which has $100 million in free cash flow as a firm growing 3% a year in perpetuity and a cost to capital of 8%. So you plug the numbers in, you get a value for the firm of $2 billion. It has $1 billion in debt, you subtract that out, you get a value for the equity. You divide by the number of shares, 100 million, you get a value per share of $10. So this is very similar to the example I set up today. This company grants 10 million options, and this is the example again I set up today, 10 million options at the strike price of 10, which is equal to the stock price. I'm going to argue that your value of equity will drop. The question is by how much? Because we already talked about why it wouldn't be unchanged because you've given away something valuable. So I'm going to take you through three different ways of dealing with options. Two are very simple, and one is absolutely a non-brainer, but it's a horrible way to deal with options, but I'll start with that. I've given 10 million options to my CEO, right? Those options might or might not be exercised. You could think like a conservative investor and do what? Act like they're going to be exercised, add the 10 million in shares to the number of shares outstanding, and just say, look, I'm going to act like I have 110 million shares outstanding, even though you don't know whether the options will ever be exercised. This is called the fully diluted approach, where basically you take your value of equity, you divide by the total number of shares you'll have outstanding with the options exercised, even though you don't know whether they'll be. The value per share that I get is $9.09. What am I missing when I do this? I'm assuming the options will be exercised, right? If the options get exercised, what do the managers do? They exercise the options, but when they exercise the options, what will they have to pay? The strike price times the... In other words, if I'm assuming the option exercise, I might as well be sensible about it and count in the exercise proceeds, but I'm not doing it. This approach, the diluted share count, will significantly underestimate the value of equity because I'm counting all the bad stuff. I'm acting like there's exercise, but I'm not bringing in the good stuff, which is cash flows. The second approach fixes that problem. So it says, I'm going to assume exercise too, just like the first approach, but in addition to changing the number of shares, I'm also going to count the $100 million that are going to come into the company from the exercise, the proceeds. So my numerator, I add the $100 million, I adjust the number of shares, and guess what? Magically, the value per share is unchanged here. The treasury stock approach, which is what this is called, assumes that there is no time value to an option. That the value of an option is exit stock price minus the strike price. They're missing the whole concept of optionality. So in this approach, you're actually going to overvalue the company. So the fully diluted approach, you're going to undervalue the company because you're not counting the exercise proceeds. The treasury stock approach, you're going to overvalue the stock because you're missing the time premium. Maybe there's a way, a Goldilocks approach, where I can split the difference. Have you gone through any option pricing models in your other classes? I know you're all lying because you have, and you're just not wanting to say it. But you've seen option pricing models, right? Foundations. If you take my corporate finance class, you saw a little bit of it. What do option pricing models try to do? They take an option, and they attach a value to the option now, right? That value, in a sense, is like a probability-weighted number that reflects the expectation that the option will get exercised sometime in the future. So an option value is like an expected value of what will happen in the future. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take that option pricing approach and bring it into equity valuation. So here's how it's going to work. I'm going to value the equity in the company just as I do with any company, present value of the cash flows minus the debt. And once I value the equity, I'm going to value the options outstanding as options. So basically, we have 5 years left to expiration. I value the options using an option pricing model. I subtract out the value of the options from the value of my equity. Why subtract out? Because it's part of my equity that's been given away. And it's or whatever remaining equity that I have that I will divide by the shares outstanding. So I'm dealing with options frontally by valuing the options as options. And when I talk about options, I'm not just talking about employee options. I'm talking about warrants, which are European ways of raising equity. I'm even talking about the conversion option, a convertible bond, because that's an option as well. I'm subtracting them all out to get to the value of equity in a company. A little few caveats. So, option pricing models, as we know them, at least the Black-Scholes, the binomial, were designed to value short-term listed options, three-month options, two-month options. First problem you're going to face is employee options tend to be 5 to 10 years long, much longer. Second, option pricing models were designed to value options on side markets like the CBOE, where the company is not involved in the process. With employee options, when the options get exercised, the company actually has to issue shares. There's a dilution effect. And third, option pricing models were designed to value listed options where you can trade the options. If the stock price goes up, it almost never makes sense for you to exercise the option. You're going to sell it to somebody else. Employee options cannot be traded. Let me explain why this matters. Let's say you are employee number 5 at Snap. You were given options when people thought the shares were worth 25 cents apiece. So So you have a million options that you got with a 25 cent strike price. What's the what was the stock price yesterday at the close of trading for Snap? It's close to like $27, $28. You're happy right now, right? You become a millionaire. You're worth $27 million. But you're a little scared. What are you scared of? Stock price has hit 27. Forget about the taxes. Even before the taxes, you're worried that if you kept holding, you have 5 years left on your option. You can hold it for 5 years. But you're worried that this is a brief moment of glory and you could be the next Twitter. And the next thing you know, you could be back to six. So you don't want to wait. You're worried. You can't sell the options. You're not allowed to. Employee options are not liquid. So what might you do even though you have 5 years left on the option? You might exercise today and collect your cash. Even though you might owe taxes, employee options get exercised about halfway through their regular life. Regular options almost never get exercised early. They always get sold to somebody else. Employee options get exercised early. Somehow I've got to incorporate all of that into my option pricing model. The dilution, the early exercise, and I think I can do it. So here's what I did. I took the stock price and the strike price for these options. I took the maturity, which was 10 years, and the standard deviation of the stock price, which is 40%. So basically, these are all inputs I need for the option pricing model. And when I valued the options, even though these are at-the-money options, the value that I got for the option was $5.42 per option. How many options did I give him? 10 million options. 10 million times $5.42 means I've given away $54.2 million to my CEO. I'm going to subtract that out from my billion-dollar equity value. By doing that, I've taken care of past option grants. I can now divide by the actual number of shares. So don't double count. Don't increase by 10 to 110. Leave it at 100. I get a value per share of 946. You remember what the fully diluted approach gave me as an answer? $9.09. The treasury stock approach gave me $10. With the option pricing approach, I'm getting right down the middle, $9.46, because it captures the optionality in options. So let's review. If your company has options outstanding, the diluted stock approach, you just adjust the number of shares. The treasury stock approach, you adjust the number of shares and add in the proceeds. With the option approach, you value the options as options and subtract it out. And even though I've called these three approaches, I don't think the first two approaches really even should be used in valuation, even though they get used. I think we should be valuing options as options and doing what we just did. That's why every one of my DCF models, and I'll send you this Thursday, I'm going to send you some links because I know some of you are still holding back on starting on the valuation. You can build your own Excel spreadsheets. I have absolutely no problem with it, but that takes some time. So if you want to get a jump, you want to get a valuation of your company, I'm going to send you, and every one of my valuation spreadsheets has an option worksheet built into it, where if you have employee options, I value the options, and so I do what you just saw there. So you don't even have to get your hands dirty using option pricing models. You just have to at least intuitively realize what I'm doing, which is valuing the options and taking them out of the value. Any questions? A little tweak that you have to think about is the way the taxes are set up. But until 2007, a little bit of accounting background. Until 2007, if you were a company that granted options in the U.S., the accountants treated options based on exercise value today. So if you granted options at the money, the accountant said, it's not an expense, don't worry about it. And you actually showed the expense when the options got exercised 5, 7, 9 years later. In 2007, after 15 years of fighting for good sense, finally the accountants gave in and said, we have to do this right. So starting in 2007, U.S. companies have been required to expense options, basically value the options using an option pricing model and show it as an expense. So when you look at a cost of goods sold for a Snap or a Uber or a Tesla, that cost of goods sold includes the option expenses associated with the options given this year. And then they undercut themselves and the analysts go along. They actually add back this expense and because they call it non-cash expense. So they say our cash flows are actually good. We actually made money before we paid people. Okay, that's nice to know. But they add so don't fall for those games. It is an expense. It should be treated like any other expense. Let it stay in the books. But you do get a tax advantage because it's an employee expense. When you give it, you actually get a tax deduction. So whatever value you get for the option, that 54.8 million, you could multiply by 1 minus the tax rate because, in effect, that's your real value to your company. That takes care of options in the past. Let's talk about options that you might grant in the future. Remember I said that 2007, the law changed on options, and you now have to show it as an expense. Guess what companies started doing once the law changed? They said, we're not going to give options anymore because it doesn't look like a freebie. So starting in 2007, U.S. companies have moved increasingly away from employee options to employee restricted stock. Microsoft, for instance, now uses no options. There's no options left over. Most companies, therefore, have shifted away. A few companies, though, still grant options. My favorite example is Cisco. Cisco has lots of deadweight costs from past option grants. It continues to give out options every year. The question is, what do I do about those future option grants? I don't know what they will be, how much they will be, but I do know they will make them. So here's my advice about future option grants. What did I say employee options were? Compensation, right? What do we do with any other compensation expense? We treat it as an operating expense and reduce our income by it. In fact, Warren Buffett once said, if employee options are compensation and compensation is a tax deduction, what's to debate? Employee options have to be treated as an expense in doing evaluation. So let's have to value Cisco. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to project out revenues. I'm going to project out expenses. But I'm going to then project out a separate line item for how much I think employee options will be as a percentage of revenues. And I'm going to subtract that as well. Which means my future earnings are going to be lower for Cisco, my future cash flows are going to be lower, and because my future cash flows are lower, my value is going to be lower. And then I'm going to subtract out the value of options outstanding today. And when I do that, people think I'm double counting. Am I? Because I seem to be punishing Cisco twice, right? Once by lowering their earnings and their cash flows, and after I've come up with the value, again by subtracting out options. Why is that not double counting? What's the first part of what I'm doing the cost of? Future option grants, right? That's what that does. What's the second part of what I'm doing? Past option grants. For a company like Amazon that has past option grants only and has no more future option grants, I'll punish them only once. For a company that has no past option grants that I think will grant options in the future, I'll punish them only once. But if a company like Cisco that has both, I have to punish them twice. It's two different sins, and they both affect the value of my equity. Final point about employee options and what makes them so incredibly messy. If you look at the kinds of companies that grant employee options, companies like Snap, right? They're young companies. They're very volatile, very risky companies. And these options are really long-term options. You think, so what? The value of an option is a function of risk, right? The higher the risk, the more valuable the option. So a company like Snap grants options. They're worth a lot more than a company like Procter & Gamble. The kinds of companies that grant employee options are exactly the kinds of companies where you worry the most or should worry the most about the consequences of those options. Do you know where to find options if your company has options in your financials? First, assuming you've picked a company and gotten a 10K, my suggestion is that you download the PDF version of the 10K. Don't print it off. Don't waste paper. One of the advantages of having a PDF version of the 10K is you can search the 10K on your computer. You don't have to go page one, page two, page three. So when you want to find lease commitments, just type in lease commitments or rental commitments. It'll find it for you in there. Once you download the 10K for your company, check. Type in the words employee options. And if your company has options outstanding in the U.S., the company will have to tell you how many options are outstanding. Say 2.3 million. It'll have to give you an average exercise price for the options, and it'll also have to give you an average maturity for the options. Do you see why that helps? Because value an option, you need maturity, so you have all that information. The one thing that might throw you off is they'll actually give you total options and vested options. It's two separate columns. Vested option number will always be lower than the total option number. What are vested options again? These are options where the employees have stayed on long enough that the options are theirs. So if you're not vested, it'll show up as total options, but until you actually get vested, you don't have the right to those options. I actually use the total options, not the vested option, the assumption that if you have enough options outstanding, you're probably going to stay around, and I should be incorporating that into the value of the company. Okay. So let's summarize the loose ends. You start with the DCF valuation, free cash flow of the firm at the cost of capital. You stop and do what with cash? Normally, you just add the cash balance, but you're going to have to stop and ask the question, do I trust this company with my cash, right? And what's going to drive the answer? The history of the company. If it's a history of bad projects, you might punish the company by discounting the cash. Second stop, check and see if your company has cross holdings. Don't look for the word cross holdings. They might never mention that word. But on your balance sheet, here's what you're looking for. On the asset side, look for things like investments in other companies on the asset side. That means they have cross minority holdings. And on the liability side, what are the words you're looking for? Minority interest or non-controlling interest, which means that. So look for clues. It might not be directly stated. I wish it were. I think they should. But if you see those words, you know you have to be careful. And if you get a chance, download the Yahoo 10K to see how they report the Alibaba and the Yahoo Japan. You're going to be shocked at how opaque the reporting is. And this is a company where all the value comes from those two holdings. Okay. So do the cross holdings. In fact, just as an aside, when I did that post on Yahoo at the end of the post, I closed by saying, Yahoo should, this was 4 years ago, I said, Yahoo should just go down to one employee. It could be Marissa Meyer. And all she should do every day, she'd be given two terminals. And every day she would come in and look at the two terminals. And one terminal would be the price of Alibaba, the other one the price of Yahoo Japan, and then she can go home. Because really, that's all that's left of Yahoo, right? So cross-holdings can be a mess. Third stop, check to see whether there are any other assets. For God's sake, don't double count. Don't double count things that they already own that you've counted the cash flows. Fourth step. It's a complex company. If you want to punish them, that's your last chance to punish them. Then look at the debt that you want to subtract out. And finally, check for those other claims in your equity, because otherwise you can overestimate the value of your equity substantially in these companies. On Wednesday, we're going to talk about connecting storytelling to number crunching. Remember that very first session? I'm actually going to take you through the process of going from story to numbers. And you know what would help? If you started thinking about your company, because I want you to think about the story you tell about your company and how to connect it to numbers. So start thinking about your company before you come in on Wednesday. So I'll see you on Wednesday. Thank you.
you drop the value of the option. That's where it comes from. Lack of liquidity is from. In fact, there was talk about 6 years ago, the SEC was actually going to allow employee options to trade. And they pulled back on it. If they had, that would be like right now. So you tell me there's a cheaper business, and I'll say, okay, show me the place, and then you have the cheaper business, and then add the 500 million. And subtract out the 220 for the new building if you want to do it. There's always a choice, any option. I can stop you in this factory and move it out so it will be fine. Yes.
So I calculated my cost of capital. So for getting the cost of debt, I calculated the interest coverage ratio, and then so I got a rating of a B. And for U.S. Steel, well, actual rating around a B, C plus. Actual rating, and then for my cost of my leverage, beta, my leverage beta I got 1.7, while like Google has 2.7, and then Yahoo has 4. So like.
That's irrelevant. Once you go down the bottom of page, why is the bottom of page so low?
I basically averaged. I went on your website, got the beta.
That's unlevered beta, but you still have.
Yeah, I levered it. Yeah, the
so
levered.
Debt to equity ratio is not through the roof.
My debt to equity, my market debt to equity ratio is around 85.
You sure you're not debt to capital?
I did debt to equity.
You have only an 85% debt to equity ratio.
The market cap's around 6. The U.S. called the debt's around 3.
That doesn't reconcile with the rating.
Because the EBIT's negative last year.
Right, because the EBIT is negative, market cap is